What is the importance of philosophy in the 21st century as we enter a post-truth world? How can we reintroduce meaning and uphold moral principles in our world shaken by crises? And what does philosophy teach us about living in harmony with the natural world?
Robert Pippin is the Evelyn Stephenson Neff Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, where he teaches in the College, Committee on Social Thought, and Department of Philosophy. Pippin is widely acclaimed for his scholarship in German idealism as well as later German philosophy, including publications such as Modernism as a Philosophical Problem and Hegel's Idealism. In keeping with his interdisciplinary interests, Pippin's book Henry James and Modern Moral Life explores the intersections between philosophy and literature. Pippin's most recent published book is The Culmination.
Robert Pippin, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you.
So thanks for joining us today. Before we get into your latest book, The Culmination, just tell us a little bit about your academic journey. You know, just take us back to your early years and how that influenced your view of the world.
Well, I grew up in the Deep South in Jacksonville, Florida, with a lower working class family. No one had gone to college. My father was the son of a sharecropper, never went past the sixth grade. I was basically saved by a high school teacher who sent me to Trinity College. And at Trinity, I was an English major. I started out wanting to be a fiction writer. But I got interested in philosophy thanks to some really charismatic and interesting teachers that I had at Trinity. And I decided I wanted to study Greek and German philosophy especially. And in the United States, given the nature of the organization of professional philosophy, there weren't many universities, certainly not any elite universities where that could be done. So I went to Pennsylvania State University, which is a very strong program in both ancient and modern European, especially German philosophy. And I wanted originally to write a dissertation on Plato, but because of a kind of fellowship opportunity, I sort of fell into writing about Kant. So I wrote a book about Kant's theory of form, oriented from what would be later Hegelian criticisms of the Kantian theory of formality. So I graduated in 1974 with this dissertation and accepted a job at New College at Sarasota, Florida. But New College, during the year that I was there, ran out of money and sold itself to the University of South Florida as an honors college. So I then got a job at the University of California at San Diego, which was a perfect job for me. They had a very strong history of philosophy department and very strong contemporary Anglophone philosophy department. So I was there for 17 years. My colleagues were people like Herbert Marcuse and Henry Allison, Fred Olson. But in 1991, I got an offer from the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago to come to Chicago. It was difficult, I mean, moving from San Diego to Chicago, but the job was so perfect for me because I had these interdisciplinary interests going all the way back to modernism as a philosophical problem that I was really interested in joining, you know, the illustrious sort of history of the people who'd been in the Committee on Social Thought, Hannah Arendt and Leszek Kolakowski and people like that. That I accepted the job, we moved to Chicago, and I became, after 2 years, chair of the Committee on Social Thought and was chair for 26 years, hired a whole bunch of people. We sort of rebuilt the committee. And it was at Chicago that I had been given permission, essentially, an academic paradise. I could teach and write about whatever I wanted. So I continued to write on German philosophy, but in the late 90s, I got interested in writing on philosophy and literature and wrote a book on Henry James called Henry James and Modern Moral Life that did quite well. And I continued to be interested in both German philosophy and writing about literature, Proust especially. But I also got very interested in film and the work of Stanley Cavell, Victor Perkins, George Wilson, various other philosophers who were interested in film. And so I've been writing books about film as well. First one was Hollywood Westerns and American Myth, the importance of Howard Hawks and John Ford for political philosophy.
And so you've been walking on this path with Hegel and Heidegger for a considerable time. Why did you choose them as companions on your journey? And how have they opened a window onto the world for you?
I guess I became known in philosophy for a defense of the philosophy of Hegel, which in the Anglophone tradition had never been, in a way, properly received because it was considered that his philosophy was too obscure, too outdated, too ambitious, in a way, for the taste of more deflationary contemporary philosophy. So I engaged in a long 30-year project to reanimate philosophical interest in Hegel by trying to understand the relationship between Hegel and Kant, especially, and his relationship to ancient philosophy, and arguing that he had a bearing on many contemporary philosophers like Wilfred Sellers or John McDowell, Robert Brandom. But that also prompted a lot of interest, and I traveled around the world defending this Hegel thesis. But at some point, when I was writing a book about the most difficult book in Hegel, Hegel's Science of Logic, I realized that the only other philosopher who had the same interpretation of Hegel that I did was Martin Heidegger. So wanting to understand why Heidegger thought that Hegel's position fundamentally didn't work, that something had been left out, that something had been forgotten or missed, led me to a very serious engagement with Heidegger's major works. And that led to the publication of The Culmination. Heidegger, German idealism, the fate of philosophy. So that's what I'm doing now, is trying to explain, especially to my old Hegelian colleagues, why I now think that there's something missing in Hegel.
And just drawing back in the broadest sense, before we dive into the culmination, what for you is the importance of philosophy in the 21st century? So many things are being shaken up, particularly with AI and all the new technologies and entering a post-truth era. And just how do you reorient your thinking about this changing world and the importance of philosophy?
Well, philosophy is both an academic discipline, confined mostly to university life, and yet it's also something that everybody does. Everybody unavoidably has to have reflective views about what's significant or important to them. They also have to justify to themselves why it's significant or important. So everybody does philosophy. It's everywhere. It's in film and literature and television and music. But on the other hand, to confront those questions like having a just society, the nature of justice itself, and the various opinions that have been written in philosophy about justice can get to a very high level. So there's this unusual connection between philosophy and human life, on the one hand, since everyone does philosophy. But very often, they don't do it very well. Reflection sort of runs out for them. So we've inherited from the Middle Ages this incredible tradition that's now developed into a chance for young people to spend 4 or 5 years, in a way, released from the pressures of life. And especially in America, allowed to live in these kind of residential cloisters and given an opportunity for once in their life to actually engage with the issues that everyone has to engage with, but at a much higher level and a much deeper level. Of course, when they get out of college, they don't really have much time for that anymore. But the hope is that, at least for people who are privileged enough to attend university, the way in which philosophy is experienced in their lives later will be better informed, more critical, more thoughtful, more rational. I mean, everybody reads novels and there are English departments, but there's something much more fundamental about philosophy as the basic attempt to assess whether we're living well or not. And since philosophy in the United States is not taught in high school, the issues in philosophy emerge in English and history classes. But in confronting what the best minds in the history of the world have had to say about these issues, they get much more complicated and much more abstract. And the hope is that they at least provide for the people who are privileged enough to confront philosophy as philosophy rather than just daily life, a better and more thoughtful approach to these fundamental questions.
Indeed, we all want to lead a good life and find meaning in our lives. And it's just about finding that common vocabulary, some ways in or through the arts. But sometimes life is moving too fast for us to fully reflect upon these important questions.
I agree.
So I wanted to go back to this idea that Hegel's metaphysics is at some level problematic. And in your book, you suggest that for Heidegger, we need to destroy the metaphysical tradition in order to clear the ground for a new way of thinking. And so to what extent do you think that Heidegger achieved this kind of destruction? Is Hegel's absolute irretrievable after him?
Well, Heidegger's term is destruction of the metaphysical tradition. And that's a little extreme. It sounds like he's sort of taking a shotgun and trying to kill it. But it really is not that. It's focused on a particular issue that he thinks the metaphysical tradition has ignored, or in his very unusual language, forgotten, which is an interesting sort of metaphorical way of putting it, that something we've inherited from the ancient Greek Enlightenment, which Heidegger accepts is the beginning of the most fundamental thoughts that animate the Western tradition to this day. The central thought being the vitality and centrality of reason in understanding ourselves and the world. And its great competitor, of course, is religion. And I don't think Heidegger has any objection to rationality, but his objection has to do with the significance or importance of rationality in the context of living a human life as a whole. I think he wants us to think more about rationality as an issue of meaning in human life. In other words, in the Greek Enlightenment, and again, one always has to go back to the Greek beginning in Heidegger to get this idea of the tradition that he thinks has culminated in a kind of dead end in Hegel. He wants us to think about this fundamental way in which we sort of appear in this world without any instruction manual or any sort of general guide to what this all means, that we have these finite corporeal lives that begin in ways we have no control over and end in ways we often have no control over. And the classical conception was that the cosmos was good because it was open to human interrogation. It allowed itself to be interrogated and answered. And so the thing that mattered most of all was knowing. because knowing was the way in which we became at home in the world. We were able to find our place in the world by understanding the world, by it not being a strange environment that confronted us as kind of alien, hostile, impenetrable, mysterious fatum that we just couldn't do anything about. But that's very close to saying we could make the world over into what we needed. So Heidegger thought we had prioritized the question of knowledge to such a degree that we had given it a kind of significance as the primordial relationship to being, to all of reality, that he thought had excluded other areas of significance in human life, and by excluding them, allowed us to think of the world as, in a way, there for us. So that being in the world is just that which could be the subject of a discursive assertion, some proposition that had a truth condition, so that truth was a matter of understanding. So when Heidegger says he wants to destroy the Western tradition, I think he wants to destroy the priority of a certain kind of insistence that before anything else is important, the facts are important, the knowledge of the world is important. And of course, he connected this to the kind of predatory stance of contemporary technology, which is essentially destroying the world because it considers the world as just material stuff, which we can understand and manipulate for our own ends. So that whole interrogative, cognitive approach to the world has consequences for the way we think of ourselves as objects in the same way as objects of cognition, the way we think of ourselves in terms of medicine, of the economy, of business. And this is, of course, one of the most controversial things in Heidegger, that the original understanding of being as knowable intelligibility has influenced an enormous number of practices that Heidegger thinks eventually have cut us off from all sources of meaning in a possible life other than this successful control of the environment for our own satisfaction. And in that sense, he wants to destroy that. He wants to find a way of showing us that this way of living is actually destroying us existentially, refusing to allow us to confront other sources of meaning in ways that aren't really formulable in discursive propositional prose, not really subject to the kind of truth conditions we insist on.
So in the search for meaning and for knowing the world and naming the world, and once we feel that we own it, it leads to this extractivist relationship that we have with the planet. So how do you divorce yourself from the language that which can be a prison? I mean, I'm an artist and I understand you're doing that through exploring film as thought or pictorial experiences of the world, which are beyond language. What are your explorations of that? It's so difficult not to think, not to name the world.
You're right that the fundamental issue is what Heidegger wants us to understand about forms of thought other than discursive assertion with fixed truth conditions is that there's a form of truth that is not a form of correspondence between propositions in the world, but a form of disclosure of something being shown to us that we haven't been able to see without art, painting, or music, or fiction, or poetry. And the difficulty that you allude to is that when philosophers hear that something in a novel by Henry James or a poem by Wallace Stevens has been disclosed, that we see something truthfully in a way that we haven't seen before, thanks to the work of art, philosophers want to say, well, what is disclosed? This is really a crucial issue in Heidegger because he understands the power that if you're telling me that something is disclosed by the wasteland that we wouldn't understand otherwise, what is it? And that means translate that into a proposition. You're inevitably led to empiricism, that there has to be some empirical confirmation condition that can defend the claim that you've understood something truthfully by the appreciation of an artwork. But that destroys the unique modality of intelligibility that the artwork provides. And that is a kind of colonization of all modes of truth by philosophy. It would be like saying in a literature class, if you're teaching a poem by Shakespeare, take the sonnet, "My love is nothing like the sun." And a student asks you, "What does that mean?" And you say, "Well, it means my beloved is not very pretty, but it's okay with me." And you say, "Well, wait, you just sort of ruined the poem." You've got to be able to encourage the student to experience the poem again in a heightened self-consciousness, but not by paraphrasing or translating it. So that's one example of the temptation to discursively reformulate everything that's claimed to be true, whereas Heidegger's notion of truth is a much less propositionalizable experiential dimension that is also, as he says when he talks about revelation or disclosure, there are many things that are still hidden. So I think it's really that problem when you're saying, how could philosophy approach these issues in these non-discursive modalities? Well, the first claim is there are these non-disclosive modalities of intelligibility. They don't need to be colonized by philosophy to be significant and perhaps even more significant than various lists of propositions. If you ask somebody, what did it mean to you that all of your friends were killed in the war? You don't expect a list of propositions in psychological prose. What you expect is a narrative, a kind of story. You don't expect, well, it means proposition one, proposition two, proposition three. You want a kind of account that will help you feel, or what Heidegger said, be attuned to Stimmtzeit, being attuned to this mode of disclosure in a way that doesn't allow itself to be reformulable propositionally. And the kind of dominance of the scientific attitude that anything that isn't formulable this way is, you know, basically bullshit, indeterminate, vague, mystical, that is destroying us, according to Heidegger. It is so limiting our capacities for understanding ourselves that we have become, in a way, thoughtless in the pursuit of a kind of efficient control of the environment for the sake of maximum preference satisfaction, the contemporary economistic model of rationality, that we've lost touch with what any of this struggle for control and manipulation is for.
Right. And so given this distinction between poetic and rational attunements, I wanted to circle back to the question of feeling at home in the world through reason. So as you write, Heidegger thinks that philosophy begins with being gripped by the paradox of homesickness. And incidentally, Robert Frost says the same for poetry, that it begins with a homesickness and a lump in the throat. So how do poetry and philosophy's responses to homesickness differ? Is philosophy capable of responding in a way that doesn't end up in the propositional homelessness that you describe?
Yeah, well, the question for Heidegger has to be asked in a way kind of historically. His view is we lost our sense of being at home in the world by virtue of the Greek Enlightenment and our inheritance of it, because he thinks in the pre-Socratic or the tragic culture of the Greeks, prior to the domination of philosophy, there was a way of understanding ourselves and our place in the world that didn't create this notion of subjects as a kind of sovereign being and everything else being an object for that subject. So the main interest he has is in the late modern consequences of this spiritual alienation in the world. And one of the ways, let's say, modernist literature speaks to this problem is by helping us to articulate rather than overcome this homelessness, this sense that we have no real understanding of how to evaluate significances, things that matter to us in a way that is other than successfully manipulating objects. But literature can help us understand the situation we're in. And here's a very big difference with Hegel. Hegel thinks that if we can articulate our dissatisfaction, we must already have within that articulation a way of thinking about its overcoming. And that's a very deep issue that is involved in Hegel's philosophical logic. It's involved in the issue of dialectic. And it's the one thing Heidegger thinks is an illusion. We don't know what to do by knowing just that we're not going on very well. But much of the focus of Heidegger is on the implications of what he thinks is a wrong path taken by the Western metaphysical tradition that has led us to a situation in which, you know, there's a line in King Lear, the worst is not yet, so long as we can still say this is the worst. And Heidegger thinks we may have reached a point where we're not even able to say anymore, this is the worst, where we have forgotten so much that we think of what would be experienced as the worst as normal, as just the everyday, as just what life is. So great literature, especially modernist literature, which is a literature of alienation and despair and doubt, can awaken us at least to what we've lost. That doesn't mean we now know what we need to recover, but we need something like a new orientation, not a new doctrine. That's the other interesting thing about Heidegger. It's just the question of the meaningfulness of being, his central question, is not one that should be formulated in terms of a doctrine, as if there's an answer to it. The most important things we need to understand to live in a way that we find meaningful are not contentful claims about what it is to live meaningfully. That's another thing that makes Heidegger sort of stand out among all philosophers, by insisting on these non-discursive modes of orientability in the world that he thinks poetry, or what he calls poetry, he means basically all the arts, can provide us. So the question of homelessness for him is both a fundamental question about the human struggle, but also one that has reached a crisis stage in Western history. And it's important to remember that the celebrations of modernity by people like Kant, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel were all written in the shadow of the French Revolution, the end of feudalism, the democratization of modern institutions, the end of religious warfare. They thought we were home free, and it's quite understandable that they thought we were free by virtue of the achievements of reason in creating the conditions of a free life. Heidegger wrote constantly in conditions of economic crisis, two world wars, the aftermath of those wars. So Heidegger is a philosopher of crisis. And one of the tasks he thinks philosophy has now is awakening us to a crisis we don't even know any longer we're going through, which is a kind of strange, paradoxical position. You could be living in a nightmare without knowing you're living in a nightmare. How's that possible? But Heidegger has a lot to say about how it's possible.
So on that last note about Heidegger as a crisis philosopher, or one whose project largely responds to and is informed by the context in which he was writing, how should we think about his affiliations with the Nazi Party? To what extent do they impact upon his work?
Yeah, well, that's been a much debated question. There are people who think Heidegger should be considered not even as a philosopher, but as a Nazi ideologue. So Heidegger joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and was, as a Nazi, the rector of the University of Freiburg for 6 months. During this period, actively participated in the purging of Jewish faculty members. When he wrote the second edition of Being in Time, he eliminated his dedication to Edmund Husserl, because Husserl was a Jew, and he wrote awfully ugly things about what he called the Jewification of philosophy and so forth. So there's no question that Heidegger was a committed Nazi. But now the question gets to be more interesting when one asks, is there anything in Heidegger's philosophy? I mean, for example, one of the greatest analytic philosophers, Frege, who was a logician, was a completely committed anti-Semite. But no one would really claim that Frege's discovery of the quantifier or his formulation of quantificational logic is deeply connected with his anti-Semitism. So one way of dealing with Heidegger's position is just to say that as a person, as a human being, he was a swine. But that has nothing to do with his philosophy. That would be the easiest way out. And I don't think myself that there is any connection between any aspect of Heidegger's philosophy and anti-Semitism and totalitarianism. However, it is true that Heidegger was writing when the world, especially Germany, considered itself as under threat from, on the one hand, absolute soullessness and materialism, and on the other hand, communism, and that something extremely radical had to be done to save us both from the ruthless version of American capitalism on the one hand and the world revolutionary attempt at collectivization and a totalitarian state by communism on the other. So one of the ways of looking at Heidegger is that in this situation of intense crisis, he and many others, especially those who in the 30s joined the Communist Party, thought that radical solutions were called for. That is the most dangerous thing about his philosophy, that when you come to a philosophical position in which you think the resources of the tradition are no longer adequate for, in effect, defending ourselves against unpalatable alternatives, you're tempted to take extreme measures. If you think, as in the present, the post-2008 world, the absolute triumph of global finance capitalism with no real oppositional, progressive, united movement opposing it, you might think what we have to do is start throwing bombs like the Red Army Brigade or the Rote Armee Fraktion. You might be tempted to think that something absolutely radical is necessary. So the crisis atmosphere created around philosophy does tempt one, not necessarily, but to, well, order communism of the Stalinist variety, because you think that's the last chance for human civilization to preserve its own humanity. The other explanations are all biographical, that Heidegger was never interested in politics or Nazism until he married his wife, Elfriede from Berlin, who was a very, very committed anti-Semite. There are people who say, well, Heidegger really didn't understand what he was doing. I mean, he was from a very small town, didn't know very much about the world, and was just seduced by this ideology that he didn't really understand. Or other people say, well, his version of Nazism was so bizarre that you can't even call it Nazism, but none of that's true. I think the most important thing to say is that he committed the greatest sin in philosophy in the history of the world, the stain on philosophy itself, but it wasn't something that I think is a necessary implication of his philosophy, even though his philosophy could, in its sense of our desperation, create solutions that are quite dangerous.
Right. And so, and of course, they're different, but it often feels as though we are experiencing something like a crisis atmosphere today, especially considering the way that the media exacerbates the sense that there's always a new crisis. But it seems like philosophy is sidelined in the conversations that are related to crisis. So I was wondering if you find that philosophy today registers or responds to an atmosphere of crisis.
Actually, no. In terms of positions that are available in, let's say, professional philosophy done in the university, the most influential oppositional movement in philosophy, something like, we can't keep doing this, we have to do that. Given the collapse of the international Marxist movement and kind of moderation of wealth distribution policies and the triumph of market economics in the world today, if you ask yourself, what is the major philosophical position that represents hope for a more equal and just society? It's certainly not the Democratic Party in the United States or the SPD in Germany or one of the many left parties in France or the Liberal Party in England. I mean, there isn't much of a consensus about what to do. I think sensible and caring people would like there to be more equitable income distribution, a more humane tax policy, early childhood education, universal health care, perhaps even a guaranteed income. But in terms of the options that are being discussed, there isn't a coherent philosophical alternative to market economic capitalism. And again, now, Heidegger is relevant here because normally when we would ask ourselves, what's responsible for the basic wrongness of the world, the banality of most ordinary lives, the boredom, the ever more simplification and stupidification of labor, you'd think it's the basic steering mechanisms of society, the economy, national government, to some extent still religion. Well, Heidegger's point is that we have to ask ourselves a deeper question. Why does the form of life that we live, particularly in the West, seems so inevitable? And he thinks there are much deeper presuppositions behind the fixity and unmovability and unresistibility of capitalism and consumerism and the growing dependence of technology. This is one of the things Heidegger was quite prescient on, that technology is not just a tool that we use to achieve our ends. It actually infects the meaning of our lives in ways that we find very hard to address and overcome without radically rethinking why we just assume it's impossible to do anything about the fact that unbelievably ugly pornography is available to 10-year-old boys by clicking a button. What society in the history of the world would tolerate that? It's just an astonishing fact. We tried to do something about that, but we can't. We have this sense that social media has destroyed democratic political will formation in the world. Well, nothing we can do about it. Something's wrong about the way we're thinking about our deepest assumptions about what is rational, what is meaningful. We tend to think of the question of meaningfulness now as a matter of just subjective preferences. We don't seem to realize that we inherit a kind of world of possible meaningfulness that we are not really the subjects of, but subject to. And we're thoughtlessly assuming that the nature of our preferences and the things we think of as mattering are up to us, whereas they're very likely not up to us. So the fact that Heidegger thinks of political solutions as already reflecting part of the problem because of their thoughtlessness is extremely important. One of the remarkable things about Heidegger, even though anti-Semite, that is, was some of his most influential students, Jewish students like Herbert Marcuse and Hannah Arendt, took from his approach a kind of political message, like Arendt on thoughtlessness and Marcuse on one-dimensionality in modern society, the lack of reflectiveness, and a general culture of thoughtlessness. People will object that Heidegger doesn't give us anything in response, but that means we think we need a program, a kind of point one, point two, change the government, change the electoral college, pack the Supreme Court, you know, all the kinds of things that are discussed in America. But programmatic solutions like that for Heidegger are always down the line, whereas at the beginning is this fundamental assumption about the meaningfulness of being as just what he calls standing presence, just pure materiality as objects of cognition.
After grappling with some of Heidegger's texts in a course this year, I thoroughly enjoyed Pippin's book, The Culmination. Reading it, I felt like I could finally get a grip on Heidegger's overall project, his confrontation with metaphysics, and diagnosis of modernity's major crises. And now, reflecting upon Pippin's book in light of the interview, I find myself returning to two ideas, homelessness and thoughtlessness. As Pippin notes in his book, Heidegger thinks that homelessness is the 20th century's worldly theme, manifest in especially modernist art and literature. but is thoughtlessness construed as a kind of disposition towards the world the same as homelessness? They certainly seem similar in that both ensue from the same kind of metaphysical errancy we have inherited through Western intellectual thought. And yet, whereas homelessness implies an encounter with that errancy through a felt sense of something absent, thoughtlessness seems to resist the encounter altogether, or just accepts it as some revelatory event disclosing the intrinsic meaninglessness of human life. Homelessness, in this sense, metastasizes into thoughtlessness. They share an ontological germ. But what is especially pernicious about the latter is that it inhibits our capacity to actually experience homelessness, and as a consequence, keeps us from reckoning with the primordial meaningfulness that structures human life. This, I think, is something we can attribute to the way that technology, in affirming the culmination of capital T truth, conflates meaning and intelligibility with illusion. Take GPS, for instance. Through it, our spatial landscape is displaced onto an artificial representation. In this case, and others, the illusion, while undisguised, promises to improve our in-the-world user experience if we purchase into the representation and believe it. If nothing else, this, our self-reflective awareness of tech's fiction, is paradigmatic of thoughtlessness. We allow tech to tell us that because thinking culminates in encounter with the intractable finitude of human reason, there's no longer anything we can do to attain truth or meaning. And as a result, we identify tech's illusion with reality. Not because tech makes some kind of implausible claim to correspondence or accuracy, but because it confirms our suspicions that the world is some great big accidental mirage of meaning. One in which intelligibility, despite all the apparent lucidity it imports, cannot be prevented from lapsing back into ambiguity and illusion. And so, released from the anxiety of apprehending a horizon of meaning beyond intelligibility, we resist confrontations with absence. Sure, there's a lot of things we wish were different, but why care if we might just be brains in a vat? Why interrogate the major premises of democratic liberalism if the alternative means committing ourselves to an equally unsatisfying delusion? Better embrace the tech-spun fiction which at least approximates our intuitions about what it is to be a human in the world. The problem with thoughtlessness, though, is that it sustains the errancy implicit within a conception of meaning as intelligibility, and in doing so prevents us from experiencing homelessness and absence, the encounters that disclose our access to non-intelligible forms of meaning. Maybe we have exhausted the meaning-making potential of propositional thought. Maybe Heidegger's hope that we will shake ourselves out of our thoughtlessness by engaging with old, difficult literature is none but a dream. But I think that as long as we read books like Pippin's Culmination and remain receptive to the possibility of awakening, there's a chance we can still think ourselves behind the veil and resurrect the thinking we so badly wanted to forget. And now, back to the interview.
And you also point to the fact that we may be missing something in our educational models, which is like a grounding in moral philosophy, because you're talking about different crises, whether it's the availability of pornography or the loss of meaning in our lives, and everything is going to be shaken up again by this AI revolution and the decline of the fourth estate. So how can we reintroduce that into our educational models to give us a kind of guiding light?
Well, I don't think in the current situation of professional philosophy, moral philosophy is going to help very much. I think attention to the classical positions in moral philosophy, Aristotle, Plato, Augustine, and then the political philosophers of the Enlightenment, Hegel, that would help to reanimate a sense of what the possibilities are for thinking about ourselves morally, but even morality. The question of what I ought to do for Heidegger is a secondary question, because morality already reflects some consideration of what has come to matter to us. In the way we've understood it in the post-Christian tradition, what's always impermissible, what I may never do to another human being, reflects our conception of human individuality and autonomy that's packed with assumptions that we also want to think about. So I think really the experiential implications of teaching things like the arts to kind of awaken, let's just say for the first pass, a kind of humility in students about what they don't know and what needs to be thought about, but not thought about in terms of articles for professional philosophy journals, but considered in a way in which conversations among people in classrooms reading really interesting texts together can start to illuminate what we don't know and what we've taken for granted in a way that we shouldn't be. There's something about reading Shakespeare together in a classroom that I have more hope in, if it's taught well and if it's animated by a sense of seriousness, than professional moral philosophy. But even that is disappearing as literature, for example, is taught more as a kind of example of a sociological way of understanding what kind of society would produce literature like this, rather than the kind of awakening and humbling that Heidegger is hoping for.
So you were mentioning before how we are thoughtless in the sense that we assume that certain facts are contingent, norms are absolute, and that we don't change them. But then it seems like thoughtfulness in Heidegger's project at some level is this form of remembering or going back, encountering history and finding what is absent rather than present. And I was just wondering, how do we practice thoughtfulness towards history and in general? Just how do we attend to what is not present?
The difficulty here is that Heidegger thinks that in order to retrieve what we may have forgotten, we need to attend to what, for most people, are extremely difficult texts. He thinks that there are embodied in the great masterpieces of philosophy things we need to recover in order to get ourselves out of the fix we're in. But these texts are available only to a very elite, privileged, well-educated few. So that's something one has to accept with Heidegger. He does not have a program for social reform. He thinks all those things are secondary. They all depend on this one question that he thinks we've forgotten, the Sinn des Seins, the meaning of being. It doesn't mean what it is to be as opposed to non-existence. He means meaningfulness, the meaningfulness of being, because he thinks our original encounter with the world is an encounter with things that matter rather than perceptible objects. Of course, they are perceptible objects, but we don't encounter them primordially as perceptible objects, but as tables to put books on or automobiles to drive and so forth. So he thinks this recovery of the fundamental issue of meaningfulness requires going back and reading, say, Aristotle's Physics all over again, or Plato's Sophist, or Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. That's not something that's going to be in the high schools anytime soon. It is necessarily what we would now call a kind of elitist enterprise. And then you ask, well, what is the hope that Heidegger being able to convince a small group of philosophers with enough German, French, and Greek to read these texts is going to have the kind of resonance in the world that will address the crisis of meaningfulness that Western metaphysics has created? Well, the answer is not much. It's not going to have much of an influence. This is not that kind of thing. There ought to be many, many political movements addressing the injustices and inequalities in the world. But there is no possible political movement to address the problem of boredom, of banality, routinization of life, the fact that so many people live a life that they secretly hate. There's no way of just saying, well, here's some therapy for that. The problems are not reachable by programmatic means. So you can say, well, that's a source of despair. What are you saying? We just can't do anything about it. Well, yes, we can't do anything about it. If you've posed a problem in that way, then what you're trying to do by agreeing to do these kind of podcasts or something is to just try to address in a more general way what the problem is. So you can sort of awaken a certain dissatisfaction, a certain humbling, a certain not taking for grantedness about the way we are living. I'll take that. It may not be programmatic in the way that we'll found a political party, but look at how much irony there is in contemporary art, how much unhappiness is the focus of contemporary literature and poetry. At least that is a kind of awakening. And I think Heidegger thinks that philosophy can be that kind of awakening as well. But that doesn't get us very far down the road to a more fulfilling life for more people.
I think that solace, not feeling alone, just being heard and knowing that those unspoken words are felt by others, sometimes that's enough. It makes us all part of this family, whether it's of artists, of philosophers, or just beings on this earth.
I agree very much with that, yeah.
So you were just discussing our current dissatisfactions or the ways that those dissatisfactions are manifesting in art and literature today. So in your Modernism as a Philosophical Problem, you have two different introductions, I think one that coincides with the first publication of the book and then one with the second. And I was wondering if you were to write a third introduction today, would it change? Would it stay the same? Would you still think that a lot of the problems that are being addressed in contemporary art and literature have to do with some dissatisfaction with Western intellectual history or the conceptions of the subject that come through in those?
Yeah, I've thought about that question too. In some of the commentaries on the culmination, people have asked, you know, you had apparently a very different view. Well, in the first place, that book was written in the heyday of postmodernism when the idea was that the basic idea of the bourgeois civilization had been exposed as hollow, empty, or ideologically justifying mere capitalist profit motive and so forth. And I thought there was something still to be said about the end of gender-based division of labor. All the various accomplishments of bourgeois civilization were worth reminding ourselves of. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of reaction to postmodernism. But nowadays, especially after after 2008. I mean, in the 90s, there was still a kind of hope for an oppositional movement of welfarist, quasi-socialist, democratic reform consistent with the ideals of bourgeois civilization, freedom and dignity of the individual, moral responsibility, an equitable economic system in which people could live satisfying lives with dignified labor. Much of that seems to have disappeared. My father was an enlisted man in the Navy for 20 years, and that meant lower working class, but he could buy a house, raise two children, have a vacation, have two cars. Somebody working today for Walmart or Amazon can't do that. You can't live on $30,000 or $40,000 a year today if you have a family. And very often they don't have access to health care, which I had because my father was in the service. So I would say today, if I were thinking about the situation compared to the situation for both of those prefaces with modernism, is that after 2008, the level of resentment among those who have, because of what I've just been talking about, lost out, is so much higher that the idea of reminding people of the achievements of bourgeois civilization is pretty much irrelevant. I mean, it rings hollow. It's not untrue. You know, saying, well, at least there's Obamacare. But compared to other developed countries in the world, that's kind of pathetic. And in the other countries of the world as well, the inability to deal with the problems of mass migration, which are only going to get worse with climate change, also makes me think that the achievements of bourgeois civilization are fragile, so fragile that the idea of respecting the dignity and independence of every single individual is now exposed as hollow. I mean, when I was in college, everybody would say, well, the ideal is Sweden in 1964. I mean, that's just like the ideal society. And I mean, look at what's happening to Sweden. You know, they have a right-wing government privatizing everything. They can't deal with their immigrant population. They're trying. But the things we used to think of as the epitome of the success of bourgeois societies in a progressive restriction of radical market economics, they all just explode into right-wing nationalism. So I've become much less, not convinced that those things were wrong, but when Hegel and Kant were giving the moral philosophical foundations of modern bourgeois life, they weren't wrong, but they were wrong that it's enough to sustain a meaningful life. I think that's the thing I would emphasize if I were writing a third preface.
And on that point of capitalism and all the problems, how do you see a way out that doesn't lead to more exploitation and inequality?
Well, I don't think there is, you know, quote unquote, a way out. I think well-meaning people should continue to work towards a woman's right to control her own health care, early childhood education, universal health care with a single-payer system, all of the things that seem right now in the political climate in the United States impossible. Everybody just ought to do what they can to achieve these ends. But I'm not quite sure that given the underlying assumptions we have about why they're important, they're strong enough, these intentions that we have to moderate the effects of inequality and so forth, are really adequate to the situation we face today, which is so dominated by economistic, technological imperatives that the goodwill of individuals, which I hope will survive, isn't really much to hang a lot of hope on.
So said, you know, you were talking there before about what Heidegger said about the hidden. If you don't care about things, they stay hidden. And because there are limits to our care, to be alive is to be surrounded by the hidden. And as we awaken to this environmental crisis, what are your reflections on climate change, the biodiversity loss, and our responsibility to future generations?
Nothing terribly original. It's terrible. We shouldn't do it. And we should be very, very mindful of our duties to future generations. We know we shouldn't be doing it. We know we're facing the extermination of life on the planet, and we've not stopped doing it. The measures are inadequate. And I don't think we understand why we find it so difficult when we're faced with such a catastrophe not to be able to rally a powerful international movement with restrictions on what's causing the problem. Why can't we fix it?
Yes, I think that, you know, the technology is there, which is great. It just took a long time to develop it. If we had access to some of these technologies before, and of course, we know there have been powerful lobbies as well that hid information from people. As someone who has reflected a lot on and must be able to accept your own mortality, a lot of us feel like it's in our mind that, oh, we have forever. So our conception of time is really unrealistic, I feel, on this issue.
I think you're right. But again, I think even though there are sort of strategic and political reasons why those with an interest in our not stopping have contributed to our not stopping doing this, I don't really sense, except among a certain level of educated elites in the West, a really deep understanding of our commitment to economic prosperity as a superordinate value. I mean, for one thing, climate change restrictions so that we can have an end to the catastrophic effects of climate change often don't take into account the inequalities it would require for the first and third world difference. I mean, to tell India and China, don't use any coal when the livelihood of so many of their citizens depends on the only energy resource they have, given that we've enjoyed, you know, sort of our time in the sun, they say quite rightly, not yet. We got to get to where you are before we worry about that. I think that's another way of saying that the economic imperative just seems unavoidable to those societies. It's not even conceivable that there could be another way of living that won't achieve the standard of living in the West, but is an acceptable and humane way of living that prevents climate change, just doesn't seem to get any grip.
Yeah, exactly. It becomes a bit sanctimonious to tell other countries to have degrowth when they're just getting their growth.
Yeah. What a terrible problem. But if we could adopt a way of living that wasn't so exploitative and wasteful, it might provide a model. Or you say, oh, yeah, we're going to do it. So, you know, but we can't bring ourselves to do it.
Yeah. And also we ask, because it's important, what are your reflections on the beauty and wonder of the natural world?
Yeah, that's been a kind of transformation for me. I'm speaking to you now from upstate New York, where we have a farm with 50 acres, and we're very isolated. We're very much in nature all around us. I don't have any neighbors. We're at the end of a long dirt road, very far back in the woods. And I had always been an urbanite most of my life and agreed with Hegel that a painting of nature is actually more interesting than nature. There's some intelligence behind it. I don't know I can believe any of that. There's something humbling. And, you know, what Kant said was that our appreciation of beauty, our ability to appreciate beauty, means that we are not merely sensible creatures of pleasure. We don't treat the beauty of nature as something we want to own to amuse ourselves. I mean, some people do, but they don't really get it. The beauty of nature is an indication of a kind of purposiveness in nature that fits us at a level beyond our mere senses, inclinations, desire to satisfy ourselves. Something about the significance of the beautiful in nature reassures us that we have a higher vocation than mere entertainment and enjoyment. Some solemnity, sublimity in our ability to appreciate the beauty of nature is encouraging.
I think so. It does bring us back to, you know, what we once were talking about, the awareness of the loss. It brings us back to that kind of purity of vision. As when we came into this world, I think it just reset us. But so you speak about that desire then of the beauty of reproducing that in a painting or a film or in writing. So maybe you could discuss some of those works of art that awakened you.
I mean, it depends on what you've encountered and who your teachers were. It all can be very contingent. But for me, Greek literature, both Greek epic poets and the Greek tragic poets were a major source of inspiration, that there was a way in which literature could awaken us to things that no other dimension of human thought in general could. Then the modern novel was profoundly important for me. I felt like I learned much more about moral thinking from Henry James and Proust than I had from academic philosophy. I became friends with an art historian somewhat later in my life, and we were fortunate enough to travel to a number of museums around the world together. And I got a kind of personal education in the significance of visual art and came to have a kind of sense of the kind of sacred importance of people like Manet and Cézanne. And then I got, even later in life, interested more in the newest art form in the history of the world, film, and why it is, in a way, the most emotionally and immediately powerful art form. And I got particularly interested both in the hidden resources of Hollywood film and European film. I'm writing a book now on the film of Robert Bresson, and I think of him as equally important a philosopher as any that I've ever studied.
Indeed, because it's not definite, as you say, it allows these multiple interpretations. And, you know, your reflections on the future of education, the future of work, you've observed that education, of course, is becoming more vocational and focused on STEM, considering the rapid advancements in AI and technology and just the way society is changing. What do you see? What do you imagine for the future of education and evolving to prepare students for the future of work?
Well, again, I sound like Eeyore here. I'm very pessimistic. People of my generation who were professors from roughly the 1960s to the 1980s, early 90s, lived in the greatest period to be a professor, to be in education in the history of the world. More privilege, more money, more leisure, more access by more students. I mean, look at me. I'm first generation to college person who ended up at the University of Chicago and traveled all over the world, lectured everywhere. But all of that is coming to an end. been coming to an end for 10 or 15 years now, and vocationalization is one aspect of it. But again, the fact that we find this inevitable, that there's nothing we can do about it, that these are just economic imperatives that can't be resisted because they're the rational way of doing things. And the treatment of the humanities, especially as what you do when you're not working to amuse yourself, I think that will just grow. And the transformation of the universities into these highly administered STEM and vocational schools will only increase, and that will filter down to the training in the high schools and even in the grade schools. So I think the state of education is in a dire crisis at all levels, but especially at the university level. The elite universities, the ones with a lot of money, will survive for another couple of generations. The parents will want their children to get vocational degrees, but they won't mind if they get a little culture on the side. So those universities will do all right, but public universities will be under extreme pressure, even extreme political pressure, as in states like Texas and Florida, that will end free academic life as we've known it for a couple hundred years now.
Oh, I haven't heard that prediction, but I've heard that Elon Musk might be wants to put robot teachers into universities, and I don't want to even think about that. But yes, there is something beyond just the facts. There is something that's a relationship with the search for truth. And just, you know, what are your reflections on the spread of misinformation and the erosion of trust in institutions? What measures we can take to foster a robust and ethical fourth estate?
Well, now, you know, we're dealing with opinions that would require a great deal more argument to defend, but I think social media companies ought to be held liable for what they post. This is a large controversy that we don't really write this, so it's not us. We just provide a forum for it being available. I don't agree with that. I think the consequences of that have been so calamitous that if they publish things that are defamatory or false, they have to be suable. I think that'll solve the problem in a week. But, you know, I get the academic freedom issue. I get the ACLU position on this and so forth. But I think the erosion of public life, of the public sphere by the social media companies has been so catastrophic, and the venom and hatred they've allowed to proliferate. We would never allow newspapers to publish this stuff. And the idea that they're behind the shield of saying, well, we didn't write it, but that's my opinion. I gather it's contestable. I know a lot of very intelligent people who think we shouldn't do that, but I certainly think we ought to make social media companies liable for the harm that they've done to society.
Yes, definitely. And the other side of that, also continue to make journalism a viable profession because, of course.
Oh, yeah, right. I wish we could do that by stroke of the pen.
But. So in closing, it's been such a fascinating conversation. But as you think about the future and your search for knowledge and meaning and the kind of world we're leaving for the next generation, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Just, it doesn't have to be like this. That's it.
That says everything, really. And you've opened a window onto the world and the history of thought and art. So it's been a very fascinating conversation and humbling. Thank you, Robert Pippin, for shedding light and awakening us to the crisis. Thank you for sharing your life's work of reflection on German idealism, the meaningfulness of being, the importance of cultivating imagination, intuition, and poetic thinking. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you both very much. I've enjoyed the conversation very much.
The Creative Process and One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Virginia Moschetti with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Virginia Moschetti. Associate text editor was Nadia Lam. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and produced by Juan Sanchez. We hope you enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.